Amy and Dave Freeman are the authors of A Year in the Wilderness, a project chronicling their year-long adventures in the Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness to protect the BWCAW from proposed sulfide or copper mining. And they're here to tell us more. Welcome to the Roadhouse.
Hi.
Thanks for having us.
Yes, it's a pleasure. So you guys have extensive experience traveling in some of the most remote places. Can you give us just a brief history for people?
Well, we've traveled all over. I guess the two longest trips that we did, we spent about 6 months traveling 3,000 miles across South America, canoeing across South America, basically down the Amazon. And then we also did a 3-year, 12,000-mile journey from Washington State up to the Arctic Ocean and then across the continent and down to Key West. And then most recently, we spent a year in the Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness.
And so those are all great adventures, but do they have like a core reason that you did them, that you picked those particular routes and did those?
Yeah, so for many years we've been working through a nonprofit organization called the Wilderness Classroom. And so we had elementary and middle school students that were following all the expeditions. And so we were teaching them about the rainforest and about oceans and about all the different plants and animals and cultures that we were experiencing on those journeys. And then in our most recent journey, A Year in the Wilderness, we were still working with classrooms, but we also were working to educate adults about how important the Boundary Waters is and educating them about threats of a series of proposed copper mines along the southern edge of the wilderness.
And so that was the prime motivator for the year-long adventure?
Yep.
Okay. So do you consider yourself activists?
Yeah, I guess we do now.
But prior to this, maybe not?
Right. Prior to this, not really. It was when we paddled to Washington, D.C. in the fall of 2014 that we started thinking of ourselves as activists.
And you were motivated to do that trip down to Washington, D.C. by?
The same reason, to protect the Boundary Waters and raise awareness about the threat.
And that was the canoe that had the many, many signatures on it, right?
Right, which we named Sig in honor of Sigurd Olsen, and because people were putting their signatures on it.
So my question when I saw that canoe is, how did you have those signatures, and why did they not wash off?
Yeah, well, so there are actually, now there are three signature canoes.
Okay.
And the first canoe was in Sustainable Ely in the summer of 2013 when we conceived this project with the Campaign to Save the Boundary Waters. And that canoe has just been signed with regular Sharpie markers. And we realized that it was perfect if it's indoors, but it was not going to survive a 100-day canoe trip to Washington, D.C.
Right.
It also was only 15 feet long, and we needed a bigger canoe, so we talked to Winona and told them our plans, and they made a new canoe for us, a Minnesota 3 that was much bigger, and then we came up with paint pens. So everyone signed the canoe with paint pens, and then we actually had a young woman named Olivia, who was our support person, and she shadowed us in a car. And at night she would retrace.
Oh my God!
Amy helped with this too, like retrace names that had like partially scratched off the bottom to like make sure all the signatures stayed intact.
We tried to land very carefully, but every once in a while something would get rubbed off, you know.
Yes. All right. So back to the year in the wilderness. So we here at WTIP heard your weekly reports. It would be either Dave or Amy who would call in, and we'd get these little segments and hear the, you know, the ambient sounds and hear the sort of adventures. So how did you pull that off? What sort of equipment, what kind of planning did that take just to make that little podcast happen?
Right. Well, you guys loaned us a recorder, which was super helpful, and microphone and earphones. And, you know, so we had the full kit out there. But it was a little tricky getting the sound files to you. So we were sending out SD cards whenever we could. So people were bringing us resupplies roughly every 2 weeks. So we would send out an SD card when we had the chance. But also if we happened to be in a spot a little closer to the edge of the wilderness, wilderness or something where we had a cell signal, we would then send it in an email.
Okay, and that was pretty tricky, I'm imagining. You have to go to a high spot.
Right.
And hope for the best. And sometimes the emails would just like grind slowly through the ethers. Yeah. All right. So you're being able to communicate with the outside world was important during this whole thing. And tell us about that.
Yeah. So we were posting to social media, both for the campaign to save the Boundary Waters and on our own sites. And we used a satellite terminal mostly to send text and small photos. So when using that, it didn't matter where we were in the wilderness. We could, as long as we had a view of the sky to the south of us, we were able to send information with that.
Yeah, I mean, that was really our main focus. Like, it was the reason we were out there was to share this place and bear witness to it. And so being able to communicate on a regular basis was really important. But, you know, we weren't, like, connected all the time. This was something where we saw this as a tool, just like we see our tent or our sleeping bag as a tool. So we would use this communication equipment to send our WTIP podcast or send a photo or text to post on the internet. But it was a brief instance, and then we were going back to, you know, paddling across a wilderness lake or making dinner on the edge of the lake or you know, what normal people would do on a wilderness trip.
And did it ever get to be sort of like, ugh, we've got to go find a high spot and send this stuff out? Or we, I mean, did it get to be to a point where I'd rather not be doing that? I mean, it's sort of cutting into our experience.
Yeah, I mean, it was. There were certainly times that it was challenging, but we would have preferred not to have to trek out on a frozen lake and set up the terminal and with cold fingers and everything. But that was really part of it, and we expected that when we went in. So that certainly made it more difficult at times, but it was far more rewarding in the end to be able to share the place with so many people.
So did you both share the photography chores?
Dave is mainly the photographer.
Yeah.
Every once in a while I'll nab the camera and take a couple shots, but it's him most of the time.
They were really nice. I mean, the book is beautiful. A lot of images that are just quintessential Boundary Waters images. They're very, very well done.
Thank you.
All right, so you've got all this equipment, and I'm guessing that solar is how you were charging them. Winter can be pretty problematic when it comes to getting enough light. How did you guys manage?
That's true. So we had some small folding solar panels that we used and small battery packs that we would recharge with the solar panels, and then we could charge our camera batteries or whatever batteries we needed to charge. We found that in November, December, January, when the days were short and the low sun angle, and we had, I think, more cloudy weather than normal because it was an El Nino year, we really had trouble keeping our equipment charged during that time. In the middle of the summer, not a problem at all. Yeah, mm-hmm. So we really saw that seasonal cycle in many ways, and one of the ways was gathering solar energy.
And the cold saps or makes the batteries last less long, right? I mean,
it does. And that was a little bit tricky. Like, what we would do is we would take a water bottle and we'd fill it with hot water, and then we would wrap the batteries you know, in a sleeping bag or in a down jacket or something with the hot water bottle, so the batteries would stay warm as they were charging outside, and then we would also warm them up inside the tent before we discharged them to try and reduce the amount of energy that was lost to the cold.
Yeah, photographers will carry their cameras inside their jackets, you know, for that very reason. All right, so you went in to bear witness to the Boundary Waters to sort of educate people who may or may not have experienced it on their own about how precious this area was, right, and how you wanted to preserve it. So did you go in with the idea that a book was going to be written, or did that evolve as you were out there?
Yeah, I think at first it existed in the backs of our minds, sort of like we thought, oh yeah, someday we'll write a book about that journey across North America or across South America. But it was really during the winter, maybe because it's cold and dark and we had more time spent sitting around the tent, that we started to think about it, and we really decided that we wanted to write a book. We saw a book as potential for being another tool, you know, mm-hmm. a way to reach a new audience, reach more people, and share what a special place it is. So that's when we started in earnest, kind of putting out feelers to anyone we knew who had either some writing experience or, right, connections.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We're talking with Amy and Dave Freeman. They're the authors of A Year in the Wilderness, where they chronicled their year-long adventure in the Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness. And okay, so I just have some practical questions about this sort of an adventure, right? So how much, in terms of weight, how much did the food weigh that you had to carry with you each time you got restocked or when you first went in? I mean, what is it, like two-thirds? Is it?
Yeah, so we had over 300 people bring us resupplies. The Campaign to Save the Boundary Waters organized all these resupplies with volunteers that wanted to come in, and so we had plenty of support to bring in supplies. And so approximately every 2 weeks, supplies were brought in, except for as the lakes were freezing and as the lakes were thawing. Then we had 4 to 5 weeks worth of supplies brought in, so we'd have enough to see us through that shoulder season. The idea was that even after receiving a full resupply of 2 weeks, we could still double portage. So we could take all of our equipment and our food and our canoe across each portage in two trips. And we felt if we could keep it that way, we were basically traveling in the same way that most people travel when they go on their, you know, canoe trip, whether it's 3 days, 5 days, 7 days. We wanted to be able to travel around just like everybody else does. We didn't want to have so much food and so much stuff that we were like stuck in one place, and it was like a huge chore to move from place to place.
So you did a lot of moving. You didn't stay in any one spot for very long. Can you tell us why and sort of what the thinking was behind that?
Yeah, well, I think it's tied into bearing witness to the place. We just wanted to see as much as possible. And, you know, there are certainly parts of the Boundary Waters that both Dave and I were familiar with already. And so it was fun to kind of explore these little out-of-the-way places that we hadn't been to before. So that was our motivation. And we ended up visiting about 500 lakes, rivers, streams. And we estimated that we stayed in about 100 different campsites.
An average of like 3 days max. All right. So, you know, you mentioned in sort of in passing that you had a lot of people helping you, resupplying you, supporting you. And one of my favorite parts of the book is when Frank and Sherry Moe brought the dogs out, and what an integral part of your team those three became. And then finally it was just Tank. So talk about that a little bit. That was just wonderful.
Yeah, you know, we were really, really feel lucky that Frank and Sherry let us borrow Tina, Tank, and Acorn. We actually contacted them just because we were starting to put out feelers looking for dogs. And, you know, we know there are a lot of dogs in Hovland. And so we just thought maybe they would know someone that would have some dogs that would be good. And, you know, a couple of days later, Frank, you know, called us back and was like, you know, I've got dogs for you. Like, you know, I want to help. You know, this is something that's very important to Frank and Sherry. And this issue is. And so they saw, you know, letting us borrow, you know, really like three members of their family as a really good way to help. And it sure was. They're amazing dogs and were a huge part of the project. And we miss not seeing them, but but yeah, they added a lot.
So they came to you in the winter, and it was to help move your sled, basically, from place to place, since you weren't able to paddle anymore. So three dogs pulling a sled with 300-some pounds. No worries? No problem?
Yeah, I mean, they were kind of a mini team, right? And we had our supplies arranged on two toboggans. So we had this kind of train. So they weren't ever like pulling our weight in addition to the equipment. We were like connected to the back of the toboggan train with a ski drawing harness, actually, to stop them. If
right.
Maybe.
To keep a little control.
Right, right. And what we found was, you know, on the lakes, and especially if the snow was either kind of hard packed or iced over, you know, we flew. Yeah. It was great. And then when it came to portages, that's when we would break up the toboggans so we could haul one across at a time. And we kind of, you know, altered how we did it and had to come up with the best solution for that. And we ended up deciding we'd have the dogs haul the bigger toboggan, and one of us would go with them and help, and, you know, have to sort of like move it around corners or over rocks and stuff. And then the other person would then haul the smaller one across.
Can you imagine doing a year in the wilderness without the support of all these people bringing in food caches and that sort of thing? I mean, is that even a possibility that you can imagine?
Well, I think we could have done it, but it would have been so much different, you know. I mean, the people that came in to resupply us and were supporting us in so many ways, whether it was signing petitions, donating money, calling their elected officials, you know, just commenting and sharing our posts on social media. People were helping in so many ways that really added so much to what we were doing. And I'm really glad that it was able to be organized in that way, and that it's something that really sparked people's imaginations and they wanted to get involved.
I think that's key. In reading the book, it was clear that a lot of people really, really wanted to be connected in that way, that was something that they felt, okay, now here's something I can do. So that was kind of cool. Here, I'm going to get to the technical part now. We're talking with Amy and Dave Freeman, by the way. Spent a year in the wilderness in the BWCAW. So if you were to do it again, what sort of clothing / equipment changes would you make? This is a selfish question. I'm just asking.
I don't know. Honestly, I was impressed at how well most of our equipment functioned throughout the course of the year. The teepee style tent, you may have seen photos mm-hmm. of that was new to us, and I have to admit, I was a little nervous about it to begin with. And there's a collapsible wood stove that went in it to keep us warm, and it was awesome. And it held up. So
okay, did you switch tents then when it got to be warmer?
We did, yeah.
But so same style.
Actually, slightly different style. Okay. So we had the teepee style that was by Seek Outside, and then a Cook Custom Sewing Lean is what we used in the summer. And that's pretty cool because it's basically a tarp shelter, and one side, it kind of makes a wedge, and one side of it is screen. So it's almost like you're setting up a screen porch out there, and no poles. So we were just tying to trees, really lightweight.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so how about clothing? Do you wear synthetic or natural fibers as a base layer? I was told to ask this question.
All right. We both really like wool.
Yes.
So that's my all-time favorite base layer for, you know, my whole body and my socks and everything.
Okay, so there's a picture of you, Amy, in the book where you are stretched out in your wetsuit in a hole in the ice. Oh my God, really? This was a test to see if they were functioning correctly.
Yeah. And I should say it's a dry suit. So yeah, okay. I was totally dry suit in there. It's like my head and my hands got wet. That was it.
All right. And those held up? Nope. No little pinholes, no leaky suits?
No, they worked fine.
All right. So I have the book open at this point with a picture of somebody walking down the trail in these what look like wellies, you know, neoprene, extra tough Wellington boots. And is that something that you wore the whole time?
No. So in the summer, we typically wear either like old tennis shoes or like Chaco sandals.
Mm-hmm.
And then when it's cold in the shoulder seasons, when the water's cold and the air can be cold, then we oftentimes wear rubber boots with wool socks. And then in the winter, we're wearing mukluks or insulated ski boots, you know, that type of thing. So okay. We sort of switched footwear throughout the year, and people were bringing food in, right? And they would bring our garbage out, and they would bring warm clothes out as it got warmer, bring in and out clothing.
Appropriate clothing.
Canoe, right. They brought the canoe in and out when the things changed. They brought footwear in and out. So it was a constant flow of equipment and food.
Yeah.
Well, and one kind of funny thing about that, it was such a slushy winter that those rubber boots we used way longer than we expected. I remember, you know, at some point Dave kind of sent out the mucklucks. He was like, "Nah, I'm just wearing the rubber boots the whole time." And I think he had the right idea.
Yeah. Oh. All right. So I'm going to keep going here. There's a film that's been made about your adventure called Bearing Witness, and short film. Sounds like in my reading that it has been selected for screening at the Frozen Film Festival in St. Paul, and it's the Real Paddling Festival World Tour also, and environmental for 2017 winner. So talk a little bit about the film and where people can find it.
Yeah, the film is called Bear Witness. It's minutes long. It's a beautiful film that was done by a production company called Duct Tape Then Beer. It sounds funny, but they make beautiful videos.
All right.
And you can find it at savethe boundarywaters.org/Bear Witness. It's also on Vimeo and YouTube, so if you just search for Bear Witness.
And it's B-E-A-R.
B-E-A-R, Witness, okay. Yep.
But there were no bears in the film. I'll just put that disclaimer out there.
No bears were harmed in the filming of this. All right, got it. Okay, so I don't want to let you guys go before you can tell us about events that are coming up. I know you're really busy and probably have... I know of one, or I'm going to ask you about one that I heard. It's a benefit with the Splinter Tones, is that right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so that's one of the things.
Right, that's on October 21st. From 7 to 9:30 p.m. at the Cook County Community Center 4-H building. So we're really looking forward to that with the Splinter Tones. Right. And then there are two others around the region, so we're getting beyond Grand Marais here, but over in Ely on October 8th at Paragus Northwoods Company, we'll be doing a book signing, and we'll meet and greet from 4 to 6 p.m., and one last one that will be in Duluth on October 26th at the Zenith Bookstore. We'll be doing a book signing, and that's from 7 to 9.
And during the Splinter Tones thing, people can get a book signed if they want. Or
you bet.
Will there be copies of the movie as well?
The movie is only available online,
okay.
So it's free to watch. So you can stream it online, but it's not on a DVD. And I know that North House Folk School and Lake Superior Trading Post both have the books in stock.
Okay.
I'm not sure about Drury Lane, but there are places in town that you can buy it. You can also order it online, milkweed.org, straight from our publisher, or it's available on Amazon or Barnes & Noble. You know, you can get it sort of anywhere books are sold.
All right. Very good. Anything else you guys want to add before we let you go?
Oh, I should also say that the name of the book is A Year in the Wilderness, Bearing Witness in the Boundary Waters.
All right, the full title.
Yeah.
The full title.
You know, they make that last part really little on there, so people miss it.
Hard to read.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. We've been talking with Dave and Amy Freeman, authors of A Year in the Wilderness, Bearing Witness in the Boundary Waters, and you can learn more about their adventures at... SaveTheBoundaryWaters.com. No, .org.
Yeah.
Sorry. Any other blogs or Facebook or any of that other connection kind of things?
Sure. Well, we're on Instagram and, you know, social media at Freeman Explore.
Okay.
And I will mention, too, for those events that I mentioned, if you kind of forgot the details, if any of the social media sites for Zenith Bookstore, Prague's Northwoods Company, will have the event. So there are Facebook events for all three of those.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Dave and Amy Freeman, adventurers and local folks.
Well, thanks for having us.
Thank
it's
you.
Always
Great
a pleasure.
To see you. All right.